Okay.
Okay. Bueno, hola, ¿qué tal? Buenas tardes. Les damos la bienvenida a nuestro primer CIEL, nuestra primera sesión del 2024, que está con nosotros el doctor Peter Smagorinsky. El doctor Smagorinsky es profesor emérito de la Universidad de Georgia en Estados Unidos y es también profesor distinguido de la Universidad de Guadalajara.
Also a distinguished professor in the University of Guadalajara. He has worked with Letras para Volar, the University Reading Promotion Program, and the by the University of Guadalajara and with the Literacy Institute for several years. And he has been our collaborator. And his most recent book is L.S. Vygotsky, English Education and the Language Arts. Today, he will present his conference, Literacy and Methodology, and we will have simultaneous translation in case you don't understand English. You can go to the bottom bar and you will find the interpretation button, and there you select the Spanish language. And you can listen to the simultaneous translation by Coco Martinez. Thank you, Coco, very much. Now I give the floor to Dr. Smagorinsky. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. Gracias. And so I always like to start by thanking my translator, my wonderful translator, Coco Martinez, who always does a brilliant job of helping me communicate with my friends and colleagues in Mexico. So thank you again, Coco, and off we go. So I'm going to be reading, kind of delivering this talk from a text. And so I hope it doesn't just look like I'm sitting here reading to you. And my topic is something I've become very interested in. And I've written an article that I've sent to a journal, and the journal is still reviewing it. And the article is much too long for this time slot. And so I've cut it down to try to fit. And what I'm interested in is a certain type of research and how it gets written and how it gets read. And that is a narrative presentation of qualitative data. So often based on interviews, field notes, anything that falls within the qualitative realm that gets reported as a story or in a storied way or in a narrative way. And there has been some interesting work on how to write these. And what I'm going to do is review some of that work. And the original part is how people read these presentations or these articles, these stories. So there a whole lot of fields have turned to narrative. And a lot of research has been published from ethnographic sources, other qualitative forms that presents a story about the people being studied. And that's the emphasis here. And what I'm going to talk about is a little different from what you may have learned in training. And I hope it's compelling and has value to you in your own writing and research. So those researchers who construct narratives from data need to understand how narratives are constructed and how people respond to and interpret those characters' narratives emotionally and relationally as much as rationally. And that's a departure from how a lot of research is represented, as though it's all a big analysis, everything is rational. And I think that that is not entirely true when a story gets involved. So although the characters in a narrative is constructed for a research report is based on collected and analyzed data, they're necessarily represented selectively in the process of data reduction and enhanced with storytelling techniques and tropes. And by data reduction, I simply mean you usually collect far, far more ethnographic or qualitative data than you can publish And so what you include is always a selection from a much larger data set. So that the characters that are created from data are constructions of the author that are built from what is first a very limited perspective available from the data collection itself, because you can't collect all the data in the world. Everything is limited, and then everything becomes selective, especially when you have to fit an article into a 30-page manuscript. Characters based on data are then selectively orchestrated into a set of actors who undertake plot-driven actions within the setting of the story. Listeners and readers then respond to these characters, often through emotions, personal connection, and other readerly acts that are associated with literary reading, but in my view, are implicated in this sort of work. And so I think I said before that what I'll talk about early is derived from other people's work, and that has to do with how characters are constructed by authors. And then if there's something original here, it's how they're read by readers. So this narrative means of data representation provokes a particular sort of emotional response, and that's very key. One that ideally leads to a higher form of thinking in the literary reader, one that's shaped emotionally. Reading social science participants' representation in a research report then has something in common with the ways in which readers construct meaning from reading literature. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the kind of basic issues that are involved, about narrative perspective, the fidelity to the data, what's something called implotment, which I'll explain, and then there's a literary term, verisimilitude, that I'll talk about as well. And I really don't know how familiar these terms are in Spanish. And so I'll try to explain what I mean so that they fit both what I know in English and what you know in Spanish. So a person cannot be wholly captured in a research report. People are too complicated, their lives are too big, lives are great, and the pages you get are small. So everything is necessarily reduced and selected. And because access to the whole of a life is just not possible. And no one has a static personality. Rather, each person engages with people and situations relationally, such that the persona studied may be a function of the relationships and setting that produce the data. All data collections are partial. You can't collect data on everything, allowing only access to what becomes available through the research method. And the data collections are also subjective, given that many decisions go into a research design. We're not machines, we're people, and we make human decisions. Data are largely shaped by the ways in which a researcher and a participant relate to one another, presenting a challenge to any interpretation as authoritative. It's virtually impossible to provide a single definitive version of a complex event. And if you're familiar with courtrooms, witnesses of the same event tell it differently. They see things that are different and they report them differently. And so the idea that anyone's perspective is authoritative is highly questionable. And so when you're reading or writing a narrative research report, you have to understand the perspective of the person telling it. So the selectively mining data for a research report in order to tell a particular story is inevitable. There's no way around selectivity. It's inevitable in writing qualitative social science research articles. Yeah, so in this talk today, I'm exploring the question of how researchers who rely on narratives from participants, especially when presenting the findings in a narrative form, engage in processes of selection and character construction when writing, and how the resulting text evokes responses, often very personal and often emotional, in readers of the report. So again, contrary to the idea that this is objective and emotionally flat, What I'm saying is that the emotional dimensions of a research report relying on narratives is one of the most powerful aspects of how they persuade people of something. And I'll give some examples later. So I used the term emplotment earlier, and I get the term from a French philosopher named Paul Ricoeur. And he identifies three functions of narrative emplotment. And so as you can see, it has to do with how things are orchestrated into a story, the emplotment, how they're brought together, how disparate things are brought together in order to produce a narrative. So one of the things that characterizes emplotment is that it weaves together an assortment of events into a meaningful plot-driven narrative. So it takes all these different things that happen and makes them cohere in a story. It follows an established narrative structure. And so most of us are familiar with the idea that a story has a beginning, middle, and end, although many stories don't. So I find that to be a little deceptive. But by and large, we tell things in a chronological order within the genre of a particular sort of narrative. And there are many kinds of narrative. And it provides the episodic structure of a narrative. In other words, you edit out what doesn't fit, and you configure the events that you do include in some sort of time relation. So stories aren't singular tellings. They rely on historical genres for their form and their intent. You know, they're part of a storytelling tradition of some sort. They're part of an intertext of narratives from both within and beyond the speaker's experiences. And the intertext is the connection between texts over time. They reconstruct events for coherence and pointedness. They eliminate parts that don't fit the purpose of the story as it's being told. You can't tell everything. I just have to emphasize this. You can't tell everything, so you have to select what goes in there. They represent a constructive process on the part of the writer who is taking all this stuff and reassembling it in this act of emplotment. And they're retold by interpreters, that is, researchers, who embed them in their own version of events. So if I'm interviewing people and they tell stories, I'm a different person who takes those stories and interprets and kind of reconstructs them for the purpose of the article. So once again, all this requires selectivity in character construction and event reporting. So it's actually a very fascinating challenge to be the author of a research report that has a narrative dimension, because you then become somewhat of a creative writer. And that's both challenging, but also kind of invigorating. Okay, so I'm gonna review work by two women, Holley, Holley, and Collier, Collyer, who've done a pretty good job, I think, of detailing how characters are constructed in research reports that rely on narratives. And they wrote a couple of articles about it 10 or 12 years ago, where they elaborate what I'm going to tell you. So most of what I'm going to say here ought to be attributed to them and not to me. So what Holley and Collier do is they describe the construction of characters in research reports as similar to the process used by literary storytellers, who select which plot elements and events to include, which aspects of setting are germane to the story, and which character traits to ascribe to a research participant. These decisions follow from the intentions of the author and the perspective of the author. And I'll quote from them. They say, the author makes decisions about how to present specific events, characters, or situations that impact the plot development. The author plays an active role in determining the relevant points of view of a particular story, as well as the perspective from which the story should be told. And so one of the things that's very, you just have to take for granted is that there's a lot of subjectivity in how an author does the things that they're talking about. And even though research has often been presented as almost a sterile, objective, unemotional unimaginative process in this genre of research, the author's presence is very subjective. So another thing that they do is emphasize what they call the social reality of a narrative. And I've compared this to a literary term of verisimilitude. And I think the simplest definition, and I hope it comes through in Spanish, is it's the degree to which a story rings true in its depiction. So it doesn't, in literature, it doesn't, the story usually isn't true, but it feels true. There's a truth to it. And that's known as verisimilitude. And they call it social reality. They argue that the emphasis on social realities positions the narrative researcher as a storyteller whose representation of data produces a type of logic that, like fiction, produces effects on readers that include more than analytic logic. So it makes a certain sense, just the way a good piece of fiction does. So these implotted narratives rely on conventional literary elements, including the setting of the story. And there, they emphasize very much how important the setting of the story is, because characters can only act within the constraints of a setting and the affordances of a setting. And so it's important just to keep in mind that all the elements of literary writing have a role in this sort of storytelling. And like the rest of the report, the setting can't be fully related, but it's a selectively constructed setting based on data collected for the study. And I'll probably say this 100 times, there are always limitations and there is always selection to decide what gets told and ultimately how it gets told. So the Holly and Collier position the reader as an analytic responder, one who reaches more complex understandings through a systematic study of literary elements, plot, construction, character, setting, and all that. And that's how I was taught to read literature in an intellectual way, where you break the story down, you decode you recognize the genre and the elements. And that's known as a formalist approach to literary criticism. But over time, I became more interested in reader subjectivity. And so what I'll try to make the case next, that there's more involved in responding to these texts, in particular, a reader's resonance with the characters and their situations through emotional connections, as you do when reading fiction. In other words, when you read a well-wrought narrative based on qualitative data, you're not just being persuaded logically, you are being moved emotionally. And I believe that that's actually more powerful, that you feel for the characters. So I'm gonna talk first about how this works in literary reading and then shift to research. Okay, so there's a field of literary reader response, and I never know how widely shared these ideas are over these international and linguistic borders. So if you already know this, I apologize for reviewing it, but it's important just to establish that reader response theory has explored the ways in which reading a literary work is a constructive act on the part of the reader. The reader is a very active force in getting meaning. And not just someone who is only decoding and only doing what's called textual exegesis, which is usually explaining the meaning. Readers bring a host of experiences to their reading that enable them to instantiate meaning into literary characters and events. And by instantiate, that's a term from psychology that means that I fill the story with what's in my mind. I'm putting meaning into what I read. So in this sense, readers both decode texts based on formal properties. In other words, you You recognize the textual structure, but you also encode them. So you decode and you encode them by infusing them with images from your own prior knowledge and experiences. And that's a really powerful aspect of literary reading, I think. So a reader's construction of meaning for a story thus draws on both personal and contextual factors that produce a subjective, active response to a text and its formal codes. This response produces for readers something that Louise Rosenblatt has called an evocation. And I actually think that's the most important thing that she ever said. And an evocation refers to the images that form the basis of a response. In other words, when I read a piece of literature, I respond in large part with creating images in my mind of what the story, what's going on in the text. And what she argued, and I think it's true, is that when a big part of your response is not to the text, but to those images. And so it's a very personal way of reading. She underscores the importance of understanding the textual structural codes and cues, that is, the conventional forms that go into a genre. In other words, you can't ignore the text. The images are not just invented or it's not an ink blot, but within the constraints of what the text provides, you generate images and you respond often to the images, at least as much to the text itself. So literary reading of this sort may also occur in the reading of social science narratives and the characters who inhabit them. I'll pause for a brief example. I read a lot of history. I've read a lot of Mexican history. And a lot of what I do is imagine what it was like, what it looked like, what the people feel like in a battle, what it sounded like, you know, when people experience pain, how that felt. And these are based on my evocations, the images that I generate from reading about the various historical characters. And I think that very many of the same principles apply there to both literary and social science research reports. So understanding qualitative research report characters may often involve emotions that help build connections between readers and those who are depicted in the research reports, even when they haven't had the same sorts of experiences. And I'll give you some examples of that. So there's a term that Lindy Johnson, one of my former graduate students, and I came up with while doing a study, and that's called empathic framing. And what we found was that the students that we had, the undergraduate students actually that I had, who read social science research reports that had narrative elements, often made emotional connections to people who were very different from themselves and people that they knew. And this empathic framing, this having empathy for them, this strong feeling for the experiences of another, produced a sort of connection that changed their minds. And one of the things they kept saying was, "I've never thought of this before. I've never thought of this before." Because they'd never been presented with a narrative that moved them to see people different from themselves in a new way. So empathic framing will return in this talk. Okay, so that's a very thin version or a kind of a brief version of literary reader response. And next, I'm going to talk about the reading of social science research characters. So I'm shifting now to from fiction and briefly history to articles or books, ethnographic research reports that are in book form that rely on narrative. Okay, so these narratives all have characters, and readers' emotional responses to the characters follow from how the characters are constructed and presented. And Holly and Collier do a very good job of detailing that. And how readers resonate with their experiences, the experiences of these characters. The persuasion is more similar how readers respond to other stories in fiction, drama, history, and other fields than it is to how they respond to the sort of analytic argument that the APA style was created to structure. And the APA style, American Psychological Association, has produced the rule book for how to write these reports, but it was developed really for experimental research, which is emotionless and very dry, and it's not very moving at all. I've found over time that the APA structure accommodates narratives reasonably well. And I'm actually going to refer back to parts of those structure. By and large, the APA structure is you start with you introduce it with a problem statement, you pose research questions, you provide an appropriate theory or maybe the presentation of a topic. Then you report the research method you used, then you report your findings, and then you write some sort of conclusion, discussion or conclusion. So a well-crafted research report can facilitate the sort of empathic framing that I referred to before, a way of viewing others emotionally such that one feels for them as fellow humans struggling with life's challenges and complexities. So Lindy Johnson and I developed, I can skip this part. So I'm gonna just give a brief example, and I've had to cut the examples because otherwise this talk will go on all night. So please forgive me if my examples are brief. In the article version, they're much longer and more detailed. So the students that we developed this construct from studying were reading a book called Jocks and Burnouts, Social Categories and Identity in High School, written by a woman named Penelope Eckert. And it's an ethnographic account of a school that she studied with a contrast between what she called burnouts. And these were working class kids who didn't really like school and found themselves often physically on the margins. And what she called jocks, who were kind of the cool kids, the insiders, the kids usually with more money. They're the ones in student government and all that. And certainly at the time that this book came out in 1989, there wasn't a great deal of sympathy for the burnouts. They were kind of thought to be losers and crummy, you know, who cares? And her book made them the heroes. She sympathized completely with the working class kids who resist school and all the hierarchies that position them in subordinate roles in school. So one of the things she did was she talked about the school cafeteria dynamics. And she found that there were locations within the cafeteria that were more privileged than others. And those were occupied by the high status students. And the working class kids were very much on the margins of things, often maybe they'd go eat somewhere else or something like that. And it made the students in my class really think about the lives and experiences of the kids who are not socially that had low social status. And they began to feel for them, and they began to talk about what they would do as teachers to improve the quality of the experience of these kids that in the school are positioned very low in the status hierarchy. And they were really moved. It wasn't the logic of Penelope Eckert's account. It was the way she presented the low status students. And we felt that it was empathic framing, this emotional connection that the college kids made with them that was responsible for a shift in thinking. You know, I'd never thought of this thing before. I kept saying that. Okay, so that's where we got the idea of empathic framing. And, you know, doing that sort of research has influenced my writing of this article. And that's one thing I would just say in general. Your work always, or maybe not always, but good studies I've done have been very influential on later studies I've done. There's a progression and an aggregate of knowledge that comes from continuing to work. Okay, so I'm gonna lay out some assumptions that drive this talk. So first, qualitative characters, that is characters in qualitative research narratives, are constructions of authors that are designed to present them in particular ways, that is the characters, through the selective use of data. The second point would be, these characters and their settings are always going to be incomplete in the report because you can't know everything. And so they rely on an author's judicious selection of data that implot action in ways that bring coherence to the stories assembled from various parts. Next, the resulting story includes elements of fiction, not to distort reality, but to make the account compelling and affecting. By fiction, I don't mean fabrications. In other words, I'm not making it up, but use the language to create effects on readers that are congruent with the author's purposes and contribute to the text's verisimilitude, that is, how it rings true to a reader, often with an emotional basis. The next point, so I'm moving now to the readers of these texts. And these readers engage in analytic thinking within the bounds of the textual genres. In other words, they do the decoding, and in imaginative thinking, through which they evoke images that form, to some degree, the basis for their emotional response to the story. You often feel for the characters. As a result, this is the fifth point, the fifth assumption, and the last one I'll list here. As a result, persuasion is achieved both through analytic logic of the report and the way the readers feel about the characters. Whether or not they have shared their specific experiences or not, with empathic framing, providing bridges to lives that are unlike their own. And that's really where empathic framing comes into play. It's when you'd never thought of it before. I don't know these people. And wow, was I wrong about what I thought about them before? And this often is the way thinking goes with people of lower status than you, that they tend to be treated in a subordinate way. And a lot of the research I'm going to talk about takes people who have been treated in a subordinate way and gives them a much greater dignity and intelligence and generates the idea that they ought to be respected. So if these five premises are good, if they hold up, it becomes incumbent on narrative researchers to consider a range of questions about how to produce narratives with fictional elements that are ethically sound and intellectually responsible. In other words, they're ethically sound because you're not making the stuff up. You're not making up data or hiding the wrong data. You're being ethical. So I'm going to review some issues that authors and readers of qualitative narratives might consider as they engage with scholarship that includes these elements. So one thing that I believe matters is understanding the participants. And one of the problems with a lot of research historically is that people study people unlike themselves and reach negative conclusions about them. There's an old expression of doing research from the veranda. The veranda is like a porch that's situated above everything. And the idea of researching from the veranda is that you're looking down on these people and you're interpreting them through your own cultural lens rather than understanding them on their own terms and according to their own cultural experiences. So to tell another person's story with sufficient fidelity, a researcher ought to have an understanding of the participant. So here's another term, qualitative reflexivity, which refers to the need for researchers to work in relationship with participants rather than viewing them as subjects of research. And just those terms are very telling, because when I started doing research in the 1980s, you always referred to the people in your research as your subjects. But in doing so, you place them in a subordinate role. They're like you know, the an insect under a microscope. They're the subjects of your research, and you're always way above them. If you shift the term to participant, and I really don't know how this comes across in Spanish, but when you shift to participants, you equalize to a degree the relationship. So with this stance, a researcher is obligated to clearly describe the contextual intersecting relationships between the participants and themselves. And sometimes people do this with what we call a subjectivity statement. And these have really come into being since I got in the business. So if I'm going to study a Mexican population, I would have to say who I am, so that readers can see where I'm coming from in drawing whatever conclusions I do about them. Another way to demonstrate this relationship is to have what they call a member check, and that's, say, if I study you, but when I write it up, I give you the report to read and tell me if I got it right. That's a member check. Member of the research participant group gets a role. And so they're hardly required, but they help. They make your case stronger. So it's important to develop relationships with the people that you study. And this is not necessarily how it's done. There's a driving term we have here in the US, hit and run, which refers to driving down the street, running somebody over and keep going. Never look back to see how they did. And so this hit and run has been adapted to a type of researcher who goes, say, into a school or someplace, collects data, leaves, and never shows up again. Never asks the people what the research was about, and so forth. So what then tends to happen is you are studying people as the other, and the other is usually a subordinate role. And it reduces them in stature. It diminishes them in relation to the author's own status. So developing relationships, it helps you understand the people you're studying, and makes you more sympathetic to them. It just does. And I'll give some examples. So one way that a narrative presentation of a case can construct a character as sympathetic is through the way it's framed in the opening section of an APA research report, especially when the focal participant is engaging in actions that might not align with the way readers expect things to go. So I want to illustrate this from a study that I did of a teacher. And this was back in Oklahoma, where I used to teach. And she got a job at a very nice school. And she was really one of the best students in our program. All the faculty said, oh boy, Lee's going to do great. Lee is something else. And she was terrific. Lee is a person I admire. And I went to observe her teaching in her first year on the job. And she was teaching in a way that many people in universities would find horrible, which was she was teaching an essay form, and we call it the five paragraph theme. And it's a formulaic way to make an argument. You have an opening paragraph in which you say, the state of Georgia ought to secede from the United States. And then you list three reasons. And then the next paragraph is about the first reason. The next paragraph is about the second reason. The third paragraph is about the third reason. And then you basically summarize it in a fifth paragraph, five paragraph theme. So she was, a lot of people just find this very limiting. And it's just too formulaic. And in fact, you could write a five paragraph theme that doesn't make any sense, and it can still get a good grade. For instance, I don't really think that the state of Georgia should secede from the United States. I would have to make stuff up to make that argument. But actually, you can do that and get away with it, because what matters is you have five paragraphs and that they follow the form. So she was doing this. And the first thing, you know, I had an initial reaction, wow, this is a really good teacher. And she's doing this thing that everybody that I know thinks is awful. And so what was my dilemma then? I didn't want to write an article saying that she was a bad teacher. And she wasn't a bad teacher. She was an excellent teacher. The kids really liked her and respected her. They were learning how to write five paragraph themes. And so it became my job to understand why she was doing it, not to criticize her, but to kind of get into her world, get into her head. And I'd observe her, and then I'd interview her. That was the basis of the data. So it turns out that when I got into it and I got to know her better and better and better through the relationship we developed, she'd been a really good student in high school and had learned to write five paragraph themes. She also taught in a state where her students had to take a test that used a five paragraph theme rubric. She had gone to a university where the teaching methods course didn't really teach you how to teach writing. She'd had a mentor teacher who emphasized five sentence paragraphs, not five paragraph themes. She had a lot of students, and when you have too many students, you often take shortcuts. And then there was peer pressure from her colleagues, who always told her, "Oh, your students have to do well on the test. Make sure your kids do well on the test." And finally, her students did well on the test. So that all adds up to reinforcement for the idea that you should be teaching the five paragraph theme. It made sense. And I took on her perspective. And so the most interesting story was not an awful teacher teaching badly. It was, I finally understand why people do this. And so it opened my eyes. It made sense that she would do this, even though a lot of people in university composition programs would just, after 5 minutes, conclude she was awful. And so these realizations produced certain elements of the article by making me think about how I could frame it. So up there in that theoretical framework, how do I prepare people to read the narrative that's going to follow? Because it was produced over time. It was a chronological report on her teaching. And so I all the things that I just said about all the reasons she did it, turns out that those are all well-established themes of modern education, that that there are tests that drive instruction, that there are colleagues who pressure you to do the test, that your own experiences as a student have a powerful influence on how you end up teaching. So all these things led me to frame the report according to the issues that came up and prepare the reader to be more sympathetic to what she ended up doing. And so the way I say it here is, with this advanced preparation, readers might be inclined, before beginning to read the findings where this thing happens that they think is bad, to be less judgmental about how an individual navigates a setting, including teaching in ways that are not approved by those positioned above her in the profession's social hierarchy as experts, those people in universities. So this idea of having a relationship with her enabled me to relax my own expectations and try to understand her motives and the reasons she did what she did. And it ended up being, I hope it was a successful article in that respect. Problem is, I can't judge how other people read it, but I got good reception from it. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a different study about So one of the things about the study I just talked about is that readers were probably the people who get university PhDs often come from middle and upper classes. And so the teacher Lee was kind of one of us, and she was doing something that one of us doesn't do. But we all know people like her. And so but the problem was she was doing something unlike us. What I'm going to talk about next is when readers have no understanding of the people being studied at all. And this is where you're really running into stereotype. So a different sort of disjuncture might occur when a participant's life experiences are unfamiliar to readers, such as in the depiction of a sort of home life to which readers have little exposure. So you can think of this in your own life. There are probably plenty of people in Guadalajara who live lives very different from yours and that you don't know well and that you only know through stereotype. And those stereotypes can be very powerful. They're usually continually reinforced by media accounts and images. So this condition of readers' lack of familiarity with the lives of research participants may motivate authors to present what are called counter narratives. That is, a story that runs counter or against the usual story. And these challenge the stereotypes by which the other is often judged deficient by outsiders with greater social status. So how do authors account for their own sympathies with these participants in ways that both validate the report and also tell a story with sufficient factual fidelity to enable it to stand as research in quest of truth? So I'm going to review a study by a woman named Ellen Cushman. And this was submitted to a journal that I was the co-editor of, Research in the Teaching of English, while we were editing. And we'd never heard of her. She was just out of graduate school. And the story she told was extraordinary. It was her study was of African American residents of housing projects, of public housing in the United States, who were getting evicted and had to find a new place to live. And she was interested in the role of literacy in their navigation, as she called it, of the public housing system. And the stereotype surrounding these people is that they're poor and they're ignorant and they don't have any control over their lives and they're bad people, and that's why they live in housing projects. So when we read this manuscript, we were just blown away by how she was able to talk to these residents in very frank and direct ways. As I say, blunt and forthright perspectives on life among housing project residents. So when we read this, we asked her, how did you get this? How did you get these people to talk to you? Because she seemed like a white person going into housing projects and having this rapport with these African-American people, seemingly from a very different demographic. And so she wrote a subjectivity statement that explained everything. So not only did they shared a heritage of the Cherokee Native American society. And Ellen Cushman was a white Cherokee and they were black Cherokee, but they were all Cherokee. And so that was a form of affiliation she had with them that hardly anybody I know in the research community can have. Nobody could get into this situation that I know. If I went and knocked on a housing project door and said, hey, I'd like to study you, I think they'd say, no, thank you. But she established this rapport. She established this relationship with them. And it turned out that she had also been homeless herself before. And so she just got it. She got who they were. She knew that homeless people weren't bad. They're not stupid. They're not ignorant. They're just in a bad situation. So the shared set of experiences first enabled her just to get the access to the brutally honest views of the unstable life of housing project residents. And in turn, it led to a sympathetic portrayal of the people featured in her study, those who were getting evicted. So this is a relational approach. And by the way, what's in a kind of nice circle to this story, Ellen Cushman ended up a few decades later being the editor of the same journal. And so I thought that was nice. We published her dissertation research, and then she ended up being the journal editor later. So she was able to write a narrative that produced the idea that the residents were actually highly literate in institutional language and concepts, that they engaged in forms of critical literacy unseen by outside observers, and defied notions of their depressed state by acting with agency to find new homes when evicted. So she used a relational narrative approach to construct stories that reveal a greater sophistication among these participants than most university critical theorists might assume. And in fact, she argued that they deserve far greater respect than is typically accorded, and also that critical theory tends to rely on assumptions about people of little means that fit their theory better than the realities of their lives, because they don't go into these housing projects. They probably couldn't get in. It takes a special kind of person with a special relationship with the people who live there to even get into the building, much less engage in these conversations and gain the trust of the people being studied. Okay, and so she was very actually tough on critical theorists who rely on assumptions rather than actually getting to know another person. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to summarize a third paper. So I've tried to, if I'm going too long, someone jump in. I'm looking at the paper on the screen and not the Zoom meeting. So I've already probably run a little longer than I thought. So I'm going to try to get through this. So there's I'm going to give one more example of a relational way of telling the story right. So I'm going to draw on the work of Valerie Kinlock and colleagues, and they're all African-American women, and they're all concerned about the ways that especially Black teenage boys are depicted in mainstream representation. And so they position their report as a counter narrative, in other words, a story against the main story. And they derive their, this is actually what critical race theory, among the tools of critical race theory, is the generation of counter stories that break down assumptions and stereotypes. I'm skipping a little bit here. So what, you know, they know these kids because they know how to talk to them in part, and they have access to them. And by access, I simply mean, again, if I were to go approach a set of Black male teenagers on the street, I don't think they'd trust me, and they have good reason not to. But these African-American women worked at establishing the relationships by enrolling through the kids' enrollment in a program. They had to kind of critique their surroundings, and through this develop the trust and relationship that they needed to get kind of to get to the heart of the matter in a ways that I could not. So through the counter narratives that they generated, and again, I'm going way long, I'm going to just kind of skip how they did it. But I'm going to return to some of the things I said earlier, because a big part of the success they had in making the case that these kids are smart is through the way they wrote the theory part. And about how, you know, these kids are misunderstood. They do all this sort of smart stuff that nobody counts in school, things like that. So they worked up front to set the reader up to read the story in a sympathetic way, to promote an empathic framing of these kids as intelligent, knowledgeable, literate, eloquent, all the qualities that they saw him that, frankly, a white person tends not to see and doesn't have access to. Again, because these kids aren't going to share in the same way. They're not going to trust in the same way. And so a couple of their techniques, they told the stories, they would step out and do an analysis of the story they told. They would relate the story back to the theoretical framework. And as a result, now I'll read from what I've got in the text. I've been kind of improvising. So when I read these narratives that in the Kinloch et al. Article and the author's analyses, I feel for how these young men are assumed to be criminals in the making, destined for prison instead of college, incapable of processing their life circumstances, and presumed to be more pitiful than potentially constructive members of society. They present these young men as sympathetic and insightful, no doubt in relation to racist experiences of their own, and their hope that their scholarship will help the next generation to be treated with greater dignity and respect. Outsiders to the research have no way of knowing what's in the whole body of data. This is an ethnography. We don't know what they put in. We especially don't know what they left out. So we have they have to develop trust with the readers too. But the author's decisions have produced, at least in me, an empathic response to people who are very different from myself. And that response leads me to feel sad at how their lives have been diminished by the beliefs of the broader, mostly white society. That's what was persuasive to me, is how I felt reading about these kids. Their account gives me hope that interventions like theirs can shine a light on the intelligence and potential of these kids and help change the oppressive narratives that the young men in this study are working to counter through the counter narrative. Okay, I've got a short conclusion and I'll probably just read this. So in this talk, I've made the case that reading social science narratives produces responses in readers that are emotionally persuasive as much as they rely on analytic acumen. Their responses are similar in many ways to those that appear in fictional narratives, even as the stories are empirically based rather than fabricated. Nonetheless, they have effects that move readers to make emotional connections based on evocations, these images, comprised of images from experience or based on evocations of lives previously beyond their capacity to imagine. So when I read about these, like the housing project residents, I really have to use my imagination. And even though I've never been in their specific situation, I've felt shortchanged and I've felt oppressed and all these things. And so I infuse their narrative with my own feelings of being hurt and diminished and so on. The relational feelings with people from outside their own experiential worlds follow from the construction of counter narratives that may be difficult to implant in their own experiences. Yet in terms of verisimilitude, this to the degree to which it rings true, they may have a reservoir of shared emotions through other sorts of experiences with disrespect that enable them to question the validity of the assumptions they bring to their reading, as counter narratives are designed to achieve. The text's verisimilitude, as much as its analytic conclusions, produces imperatives to think differently about those lives, those whose lives otherwise might become largely available only through stereotype and misrepresentation. So in all these things, readers don't have access to all the data. So there's, again, and even in Eckert's book, she had to select what she collected for a book-length study. That's the Jocks and Burnouts book. This selectivity creates subjective decisions about how to portray the research participants that in turn produce the effects on readers, whose responses may produce additional narratives implanted with the text to construct in their minds an emotionally rich understanding of the data reported. So readers are very active. Readers aren't just passively responding to a text or intellectually. They're gaining a much more emotionally rich understanding of the data that are being presented in the narrative. So when narratives comprise research data, it's useful for authors to know that they're working within a genre that does accommodate an emotional dimension. It's not the dry, sterile report that APA was designed to embody. It's also important for readers to know that the text persuasion relies more on conventional logic. Some might find that equating social science reports with fiction lacks integrity. I argue, in contrast, that a narrative report's integrity is in part a consequence of its capacity to make points by going beyond the facts and into the reader's emotional life and experiences. Thus enriched, the report becomes more fully human and persuasive at a deep level that speaks a truth that's beyond the capacity of a tabulated set of findings to generate in readers. This is not to say that these articles, these research narrative reports are analysis free, as the reports that I've reviewed indicate. Rather, the analysis interprets the narratives through the lens provided by the opening framework. So I've actually had this, writing this article has reminded me of the importance of a strong opening framework, because it sets up how readers read the rest. I've written before on the importance of a method section that details how you did this so that readers trust you. And in one of the reports, there was data triangulation. There's usually data triangulation, and that refers to having multiple data sources confirm each point. In these reports, the participants are included to some degree in the reading of the data and generation of the report. In fact, the one that I reported on teaching the five paragraph theme, we left space for the teacher at the end to write her own little piece. So each measure contributes to the validity of the investigation and provides some evidence to readers that the research was conducted ethically, and that the construction of narratives is responsible and faithful to the range of data collected. So there's been something called a narrative turn in social science research, and that's what this talk and the paper itself are designed to contribute to. Understanding how narratives are constructed, how they function, and how they affect readers is critical to their effectiveness in making persuasive points. This effect may be prompted by an opening framework that theorizes and establishes the points that are central to reading the ensuing narratives empathically. Part of this effect employs conventional analysis, and that there are these analytic interludes in these reports. So it's not just the story, it includes an analytic dimension. Part relies on character constructions and plot lines that resonate with readers emotionally. None is paramount, but they all matter. Undertaking each ought to follow some standards for ethical conduct in a variety of areas: the initial data collection, trustworthy analytic method, theory that helps the narratives make sense, a data reduction that represents the whole corpus without distortion or selectivity that ignores competing themes that undermine a preferred interpretation, and the construction of narratives that have both fidelity to the data and include the verisimilitude that lends authenticity to reported accounts. Each stage requires considerable rigor and diligence. The people whose lives are depicted in the accounts deserve no less. And that is the end of my talk. So I don't know what we're supposed to do next. What do you think?
Mayra takes the word.
Okay.
To hear the comments and questions. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peters Magorinsky, for your presentation. It was super interesting on the methodologies that use narrative. This is when we are going to open our microphones for comments and questions. Should anyone have comments or questions, please raise your hand or open your microphone directly. Otherwise, as you think about it, I think the counter narratives are very interesting, and I would like to ask whether it is very complicated to validate these counter narratives in terms what you said, the example you gave about this teacher moved you in terms of persuasion, but I don't know how we can, how is it possible that these counter narratives are not, give me a minute, Peter. Mayra is asking what is possible to do so that these counter narratives are not overseen and are taken seriously instead of, you know, like reduced or diminished.
Well, I think that all the elements that I talked about need to be in place. So the theoretical framework, and it's funny because I've been doing this for decades, but I think that writing this article in conjunction with writing and trying to write a narrative article at the same time on a different subject really has impressed on me the need to set up the narrative theoretically. So so the ones that involve counter narratives work hard at the beginning, before the narrative begins, to establish what the issues are. And often that's theoretical, but it can also be historical. You could say, you know, there's a historical problem that mainstream society views Black youth stereotypically and in negative ways. And so then you're prepared for the narrative. I don't know why it's only being impressed on me this much now, because I've been doing this for a while, but it just really struck me while trying to write this other article that is absolutely critical to set it up. The method section is what gives your research method legitimacy by explaining it in clear detail. So that part of the trust then comes from, oh, I see how you did this research. And one of the things I've always thought is, if I read your method section and I can't figure out how to do that myself, it's not a very good method section. It's not that I need to replicate your study and come to the same results, but if I can't do what you said you did, then you didn't explain it very well. And so the method section then becomes very important. And then the findings is where you present the narrative in which you may intersperse analysis. You're just prepared for it as a reader. And that takes a lot of work on the part of the author. You're making it so that the reader reads the story the way you intended it, and so that the counter narrative produces the emotional response that you're hoping to create in your readers. So I don't know. I hope I answered that question, and you'll have to help me know if I did. So there's at least one hand.
Sí,
Abigail?
Yes, Peter, you did respond my question. Thank you very much, Abigail. Okay. We listen to you.
Thank you. I'm using my phone. I'm hoping you can hear me well.
I can, so I can hear you in English.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Smagorinsky. I became familiar with your work as a PhD student, and I thought that bringing Ricoeur into the conversation of how we teach and how we research writing is crucial. And I think more work needs to be done in that sense, in terms of maybe looking at the weight of hermeneutics in how we write and how we read, particularly how we read research. I would really appreciate reading more about that. And I just wanted your comment, this has to do with a counter-narrative question that we just heard, on how we do research as, for example, someone in the Global South in Latin America, for readers in the Global North. So we do have to construct a narrative, and we do have also to take into account that we have to do a counter narrative in terms of what is usually expected out of researchers in our region. So usually we have to do that very briefly. We have kind of like a license to do a context section that ironically, not many people have to do. Just if you come from the Global South, you have to describe your context a little bit more. And when I do that, I often consider all of the matters that you have just discussed. But I also wondered about my reader and how my readers will respond easier if I just get a couple of paragraphs, sometimes three paragraphs, for the context. And how much counter-narrative can I do within that genre to properly represent researchers in the Global South? So I don't know if you've thought about the narrative as a research.
So I always hope I'm answering the question you asked. Remember, I gave about a third of the paper, right? So there's stuff left out. And one of the things that Holly and Collier, one of their points is that every story has a setting, right? And they actually say that the setting itself becomes a character, and has a and plays a role in how things happen. And one of the there's become a kind of optional element in the APA structure, the context of the investigation. Where did this take place? And I think that that is, in my studies, it would be more like, here's the school where this happened. A lot of the stuff I have done has been in schools. But every school is different. So you have to establish what the context of this is in this situation. Where are you from? What nation?
Mexico.
Oh, okay. So to whom are you trying to present this work, I guess, is one of the problems. If you're trying to publish in an American journal with a lot of people who've never even been to Mexico, and even though I've been to Guadalajara a lot, I have never been to the Yucatan. So, you know, there it really matters where in Mexico this is, which of the many ethnic communities you might be studying. Yes, it's the context of the investigation is very critical. And in fact, as I said, Holly and Collier say it's it's kind of a character itself. So in order, if I'm living in the United States and I don't know anything about your, where you're writing about, and even if you wrote about Guadalajara, I've only been to a small part of the city. You know, it's a big place. There are many, many people who are there. In order for me to understand what you're talking about at all, I have to know something about where it is. And so it's very much incumbent on you as a writer to help me understand why this story matters and why this context is a place I need to pay attention to. So did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you. I guess it was more about the matter of self-representation through that story as a researcher.
Well,
that's
so you mean
been...
beyond So there are different things. So one of the things that Valerie Kinloch in the story, in the research that I was referring to, she's actually a character in her own narrative, because the kids were enrolled in a program to look at the effects of the effects of gentrification on their lives. And that's when a kind of a rundown neighborhood gets bought and all the buildings get renovated, but the poor people can't live there anymore, right? So gentrification is very problematic because on the one hand, it improves the neighborhood physically, but then what do you do with the people you displaced? They have to move out because they can't afford it anymore. So through the program, she developed these relationships with them. But then when the examples I give in the longer paper are include her talking, you know, her being a character in her own story. And so it's I would say in my research that I reported on the five paragraph theme, I did not do that because I was my participation wasn't really part of the class. I was an observer in classrooms being taught by someone else. And of course, my being there probably changed it. But I wasn't really in the story so much. So it kind of depends on who, you know, what the study is of. So I hope that helped. Buenas noches, Erica.
Gracias, Erica.
Good evening, Erica.
Hello, dear Professor Pedro Mexicano.
Uh-huh.
And to the whole of the audience, I don't have the best Wi-Fi connection, but I was able to listen to your presentation, and it made me think how, based on your presentation, how affect has a role on how you as a researcher can portray the identities of the research participants. So in a way honoring your students, your participants' identities. And that made me think, what do you think could be the role of affect when it comes to crafting a research methodologies within the field of literacy studies?
So I would say that affect is involved in everything that people do. We are emotional people. There's a book that I'm impressed by a man named Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind. And he makes the case that all thinking is fundamentally emotional. And in fact, he thinks that rational thinking is just an illusion. It's what we do to justify how we feel. So I would say that affect permeates every human life at all levels. And that might even affect your choice of what to research, how you feel about a population or how you feel about a family or an individual. I believe will motivate whether or not you want to spend your time studying it or not. So, I'm trying to back up a little bit and think about that. Sometimes I've wanted to study a phenomenon. So I spent a year in a classroom with a teacher back in Oklahoma, and where the focus was on her using art to encourage kids in their responses to literature. And that's how it began, was I wanted to study this phenomenon, but because I was in her class all year, I developed relationships with everybody. I already had one with the teacher. That's how I got in the class. In fact, I would say all the teachers that I've studied have been people that I have had prior relationships with. So we trusted each other. And to me, these are affective issues. Um, I I never went and just kind of knocked on a door and said, can I study you? Often, in fact, they volunteered. They knew I was doing something and said, hey, can you come and look at my class? And I think that that's because we'd done the relational work in advance and we felt trustworthy together. I don't know if that's exactly what you were asking, but it's what I thought when I heard you. So maybe can you help me answer your question?
Yes, I think that's what I had in mind. And also other researchers that talk about doing research as an act of love, as an act of crafting a more just world also. So I think it's your answer is in line with what I was thinking, and I appreciate your clarification.
Well, thank you. And I will add, and this is just an observation, there's no research on this, but in my experience with people, researchers of color, Black, Latina, whatever, are more likely to feel that the relational parts matter. And they're more likely to stay longer in the communities they study and more likely to go back to them later than are white people. And I think that's because they tend to study communities of color and care deeply about their prospects in life and the quality of their lives. And I think white researchers are more mercenary. They want a big pile of publications. Once they collect the data, why should I go back? Because I've got more work to do. So I've found just a deeper commitment to the welfare of others among scholars of color than I have among my white colleagues. And those are deeply felt. Those things are deeply felt. In other words, the people that they study are not subjects by any means. They're fellow humans.
Yes, thank you very much, Professor.
Okay, and it's so good to see you. I'm just seeing your picture, but I can...
Yes, like I said, I had an unstable Wi-Fi connection. Yeah. It already kicked me out of the room. So it is my latest profile picture.
Okay. Well, good. You're looking good.
Gracias, Erika. Doctora
Patti. Thanks, Erika. Dr. Patti Cisneros. Yes. Can you listen to me?
I can
hear
you.
Well, just in this moment, I am writing the methodology of a research project where we study a generation of students from the visual arts major. First, we had 80 students. We wanted to review the art products that these students had and to see what characteristics these products had by making an iconographic analysis and aesthetic analysis and social and cultural analysis of the students that produced this work. We ended up with 12 students out of the 80 students that started. Now that I am writing the methodology, I have a terrible problem because I don't know how to explain this. Mm. Well, I do know, but I'm confused. When you study a group of students, many things happen in a generation of 4 years. The students drop out.
Yeah.
The students fail, the students leave, and there's no way to continue studying them. And we only got the students that were not even the same students who started the project. Can we explain this in the methodology, how this happened? And is this valid? And what is the degree of validity of my research when I explain how all this happened so that my reader can understand why I reached these results and what is the validity of this research? And if, as a researcher, I need to explain who I am, mm-hmm. I am a professor teaching art in this school, and therefore I have this point of view, and I hadn't considered that until now with your talk. And I'm really grateful for that, Peter, because now I know that I need to present myself and say, I am a professor teaching these classes at this school, and therefore I have the vision that I'm presenting. Mm-hmm. And I was trying not to be emotional. Well, that would be all. Thanks, Peter.
Well, and thank you for your questions and comments. So I would say that you actually already did explain to us what you did. So you know, just what you said here today, I think, is very appropriate. It, you know, if you're studying a setting that's in flux, in other words, where people are coming and going a lot, it becomes an unstable place because things are changing a lot. Every new person who comes and goes shifts the place a little bit, and that's very important to explain. Sometimes when I've done these things, I found that that's kind of a finding, that a place like this is a little bit unstable, you know, because it's, and by that, you know, it's not falling apart or anything, but it's shifting constantly. And so even what you went into study at the beginning might not be what you find most interesting once you're in there. And so I would say that it's important to provide the subjectivity that you describe. Here's who I am. Here's what this place is. And that gets back to the earlier question about the setting. The setting becomes an important part of whatever, of, you know, if you're studying art education or something like that. It really, really matters that, I think back to when I taught kids in what we called in low level classes, that there was a lot of shifting. People weren't there every day. It was hard to get continuity. It was hard to, you couldn't do a unit that took 2 or 3 weeks because you couldn't count on people being there from day to day. And then that becomes part of what you need to talk about. So, you've been describing the setting in very general terms, so I don't know exactly what it is. But I would say all the things you raised are very important questions to ask yourself and to account for in your write-up. So I hope that addresses what you brought up. If not, just try again.
Yes, it's a very good answer.
Okay.
It seems that we have no more questions or comments. And also, Peter is an hour ahead. So for us, it's 5:30, but for him, it's 6:30. So I think we just have to thank you for your talk. And for being so generous and responding to all our questions. I think it has been really interesting because we have many students of the master's degree. And I think that listening someone with your trajectory, Peter, is very interesting to understand whether it's possible to say things. And it is possible to be very clear and how objectivity and truth and neutrality is not the paradigm where we are, and the scientific paradigm is changing. And thanks, Peter, for your conference and for all your responses and for this talk that was so interesting. Thank you very much.
Well, and thanks to all for being here. I hope I'll be back in April to Guadalajara, and I hope to see many of you then. And I always appreciate people who tune in and have good questions, and I hope it was a good experience for you all. So thank you so much, and thanks once again to the great Coco for her translations, which make it possible for me to work in Guadalajara. So hasta luego, amigos.
Sí, hasta luego. Muchas gracias por estar aquí.
Goodbye, Peter. Thank you for being here. And thanks, Coco, for translating. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.